It's not, what is it, next to the...
Let me know what they're going to do for the tax.
I'm sorry, family, Lord.
What are we hearing, Jack?
11:15, which is your bill.
I'll just have, I'll let you lie, because I got a couple of amendments on my door.
Call to order, Subcommittee of Aid, State Federal Affairs.
Anderson.
Here.
Dinsmore.
Here.
Howard.
Here.
Pearson. Martin.
Martin. We'll open up the hearing on House Bill 1115. First one signed up, B.H. Spence.
Mr. Chairman, my name is B.H. Spence, Chairman of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon Fire Service. Favor of 1115. We favor the bill primarily because it's becoming very difficult to get sprinkler systems in the building because of the charge of the water utility, a monthly standby charge, which we feel is unjustified. The responsibilities of a water utility cannot be limited to such items as public fire protection, such as the hydrants out in the street, and ignore the other components of fire protection. So-called private fire protection is actually not private by any stretch of the imagination. The installation of a sprinkler system in a property is in reality an extension of the public protection from the hydrants in the street onto the property to be protected. The view that this is for the sole benefit of the property involved is erroneous. Extending the protection from the street into the building is a benefit to the entire community. It assures the community that the property will continue to operate, pay taxes, and be an asset. Traditionally, it is expected that a water utility would provide fire flows and storage capability to hydrants surrounding a property. To add a sprinkler system to the property is not an additive demand. The installation of sprinklers in all commercial or industrial properties would drastically reduce the workload of any fire department operation. The property that refuses to install sprinklers is the one costing the community, requiring more manpower, more apparatus, and larger fire flows. In my department, 94% of our budget is manpower. Our first alarm response is two engines and a truck, four men for each, five men on a rig, on a truck. If every building were sprinkled, we could cut down one engine response, which is a considerable sum in manpower. Each year, the city of Fresno, California, is 84% of sprinklers in the downtown area, and they're doing this to cut down on manpower, as is the city of Eugene in their new mall. Their first alarm response will be less because it's sprinkled throughout and doesn't require the initial response. During the time of a fire and an unsprinkler risk, all of the fire protection facilities of the community could be involved, as well as those of neighboring communities. Logically, if all the capabilities of a water utility and the fire department are needed for an unsprinkler risk, then every means possible should be used to encourage the use of sprinkler systems. Removal of all standby charges and meter requirements is the first step. An assessment against the property refusing to install sprinklers should then be matched. The unsprinkled risk would then be paying for the extra workload that his property causes. With rapidly rising cost of operation and shorter hours of work for firemen, this extra workload is rapidly becoming prohibitive for any community. To summarize, we as the fire service feel that private fire protection should be encouraged because it decreases the economic and physical burden of the fire department and also decreases the hazard of fighting fire. Sprinkler systems also increase community fire protection by preventing conflagrations and exposure fires. And in the process, we can save millions of gallons of water that would be used on a large fire were not sprinklers installed. National statistics prove that most fires throughout the United States since 1894 have been controlled with 3 to 10 sprinkler heads at 25 gallons per head. One fireman with a 2.5-inch line in his hand puts out 250 gallons a minute. Yet the utilities are charging this man a standby charge for more water. In actuality, he's not using more water, he's using less water. And we feel that the standby charge removal would be an equitable thing for the man who cares enough about his community and his property to install sprinkler systems. We have a number of cities in Oregon that make no charge. The forerunner in this field is the city of Dow, Oregon. They make no charge whatsoever except for installation charge. They check their systems, the fire department checks them. There's no water theft, as is the usual. Bugaboo from the water department, they think everybody's going to steal their water, but in actuality, with the bill the way it is written, there will be a water gong on every system. And we would like to change two sentences in the bill as it came out of legislative council. On section 3, we would like to install a period after the word system in line 23 and remove the rest of the sentence. In section 4, line 26, we would like to remove the word closed. In line, section 4, line 26, we would like to remove the word closed.
Do you have a copy of the proposal?
I just got one for each stuff.
Mr. Howard.
Ben, what are some of the charges that are put on? How much do they amount to on a sprinkler standby?
We made a survey in the state of Oregon, and they vary. They vary considerably. There doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason about the way the charges are assessed. They go as high as, one water district, since we put this bill in the last session, reduced their charges from a high of $41. For a 4-inch line, in one instance, with a detector check, the monthly charge is $6. In other areas, it's $8. In other areas, it's $4. In other areas, it's $12.50. There is no rhyme or reason for the cost. For an 8-inch line, it goes from $6 to about $23.
Another question. Now, we had a problem with the telephone company on the difference of charges, and we've negotiated that out. Is there any group that could speak for all the water organizations in the state that we could negotiate with to get a fixed charge that was reasonable?
Probably the largest group would be Water Victor, correct me, I would guess the Metropolitan Water District Association, the Tri-County Association. I have 13 water districts in my own fire district.
Seems sort of, I've always hated to put a statute that if we can negotiate, and I've always felt it's reasonable, men sit down and if they can come out with some sensible solution to this water charge. I think that's all.
Mr. Spence, what, unless I missed it, what is the Oregon Fire Service?
The Oregon Fire Services consists of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, the Oregon Fire Marshals Association, the Oregon Volunteer Firemen's Association, the Oregon Little Fire District Directors Association. I think that's all. We have about 8,000 members.
Yeah, have you talked to some of these water suppliers?
Yes, sir, I have.
Asked them to cut this down and
yes,
if they won't do it?
We've also asked them to install water hydrants. In most cases, this is a useless attempt because they do only have to produce domestic water.
Are you saying that a $4 or a $6 a month charge is going to deter a large building owner from putting a sprinkler system?
Not a large building owner, sir, but under the building code, you have two alternatives. You can either sprinkler or you can put in firewall. I have a furniture plant in my district that is still not sprinkler, and you put in a firewall, which actually hampers his business operation, but he couldn't afford the standby charge.
Is $4 or $6 a month?
No, $17.50.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thank you.
Senator Glenn Stanton. Senator, would you like to come on now?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, but I didn't bring my papers with me, and we had sent some material on to Mr. Martin, and apparently it can't be found here. If we could present that in writing later, I would appreciate it very much.
You're
closing?
Yes.
We can talk about it, yes. I say I don't have my stuff. Are you going to have another hearing?
We won't have any action today. We would wait for your material.
Is are you going to take up another bill and then come back to it?
We have another bill. We can come back to it.
But I will have it in about 5 or 10 minutes.
Oh. Well, we won't be through by then.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm going to try Roger Ale.
Yeah. That must be wrong.
Legislative Committee Northwest Section AWWA.
Lyle?
Robert Heil. Heil. Excuse me, two or three times.
You didn't even come close. It's
not very close. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Heil. I am superintendent of the Portland Water Bureau, and I am here representing the Legislative Committee of the Pacific Northwest Section of the American Water Works Association. The cost of fire protection systems is fundamentally a readiness to serve function of any water system. The actual cost of the water used is negligible compared with the cost of having a system with sufficient capacity ready to meet the demand which may be placed upon it at any time. And this bears no relationship to the actual amount of water used. It does not vary with the quantity of water used and remains the same regardless of whether or not any water is used. In order to provide a useful fire protection service, the size of the main must be as large or larger than the size of the fire protection service. The supply to the main must be of sufficient size to provide the service with full flow under normal or higher pressures, as long as that flow is required. Therefore, water service of all sizes and for all purposes must be metered and inspected to ensure that unauthorized use will not disturb the supply and effect inadequate deliveries whenever emergencies might exist. The peak demand for fire protection is one of the major considerations in any water system. A case in point is a waterways terminal warehouse located in the Rivergate area adjoining Portland, having 2 16-inch fire services for which a total outside city rate of $18 per month is charged. These services have a fire demand of 13,500 gallons per minute of water. The installation cost of this on-plant fire protection service is reported to be in excess of $1 million. The entire facility is supplied with a 3-inch commercial service, which has a demand of approximately 200 gallons per minute and a minimum monthly charge of $15.90. It is then obvious that revenues from the domestic and the commercial services are paying for the cost of making available the facilities for a private fire protection. Therefore, we strongly oppose House Bill 1115 on the basis that it is a definite invasion of local determination. The bill completely ignores the fact that it costs money to provide water system facilities for fire protection and to maintain and operate those facilities. To deny recovering these costs by the utility would amount to either not providing the service in the first place or passing these costs on to the water users or taxpayers. In the case of some utilities which have extremely heavy investments for standby fire protection to industries, to deny standby charges would either bankrupt them or cause defaulting of bond issues. It is a well-established fact in determination of utility rates that normal expenses and recoveries of investments should be distributed among all customers as nearly as possible in proportion to the cost of supplying service. The right to use water is as valuable as the water itself. Water purveyors must expend from 10% to 30% of their investment for fire protection requirements to make water available for fire protection. It would be unfair and discriminating to shift the entire burden of private fire protection to the domestic and commercial user, which supports the installation, operation, and maintenance of the supply and distribution system. The proposed water flow alarm device is in present use in many systems, but it is subject to malfunction, and total reliance should not be placed upon it as a substitute for a detector check meter. All alarm devices can be shut off when water is being used. The electrical devices by a switch or removal of a fuse, and water-actuated alarms can be closed by a valve. This bill also proposes use of a detector check meter in specified cases and allows a charge not to exceed $24 a year. This meter only indicates the use of water and is not sufficient to protect unauthorized use. The charge of $24 a year would be completely unrealistic for the reading of meters and maintenance of services.
Mr. Howard.
Mr. Pyle, is it?
Yes.
Mr. Pyle, when you spoke of Rivergate area, now when you laid those 19-inch lines or 18-inch lines down in there, weren't they mostly for water supply and for hydrants?
Hydrants and fire protection service.
You have to have the hydrants down in there. Well, then when you hook onto a sprinkler system, if you have a sprinkler system, 9 out of 10 times, the only time that there's any fire at all is right where that first sprinkler is. Very little water will go through. And I'm retired from the Board of Fire Department, and I've seen fires that would go to major proportions be put out by a sprinkler system. You've already laid your line for the hydrant. Now, why does it cost so much more to run a line in to hook into a sprinkler system?
It's the overall cost of the entire system. It's not just the cost of the fire sprinkler system.
Well, no.
But the Rivergate area, is, in this case, happens to be outside the city of Portland. The major cost of laying this service, because of the high demand on fire protection, was certainly, I would say, about 75 or 80% for fire protection alone.
Now, in with the telephone company, the railroads, the truck lines, everything is regulated by the PUC. We have uniform charges. Would you object to a bill that would say that all water districts must charge a uniform cost for their service?
No, Representative Howard, I don't think this would be discriminating. I think costs are different in various areas. All we wish to do is recover part of the cost of our system. We don't feel certainly that this $24 that has been represented here would be at all equitable. But I don't think a uniform cost throughout the state would not be satisfactory.
Some of these are charged real high, and 2 years ago, before we introduced a bill like this, one of them was perfectly high, but after a bill was introduced, they lowered their rate. I just wondered is there an organization that could talk to the water bureaus around the state and say, fellas, let's try and set up a uniform charge and negotiate this thing?
Well, most all cities and many water districts belong to the American Water Works Association. However, I certainly don't think they all do.
Would you object to sitting down and talking with...
Certainly not. I haven't seen that rate schedule, so I really don't know what some of that might be.
I just glanced at that a long time, but I know there's a great variance in the water rates. And I'm certainly, you being from Portland, every basement in Portland is sprinkled, as you know, in the downtown area. I'm sure that you realize the value of a sprinkler system in a firefighting system. I think what they're trying to do is make it so that we encourage people to put in sprinkler systems over other methods of firewalls or whatever it is, because a sprinkler system is the most effective of all the firefighting systems. And I know that we've always had good cooperation with the city of Portland as far as fire department.
Sure.
And I don't want to pass a bill like this unless the water service around the state are not real. And if we could sit down and take a look at these things and discuss it, I'll be glad to wait on this bill.
Well, Representative Martin asked a question a few moments ago regarding whether or not the cost involved might delay or postpone the building of a large building. I think this gentleman is...
You're giving that guy credit. He doesn't deserve it. Jack, remember
I'm sorry. But this... I think this is unreasonable to even assume that this might be the case. We're only talking about $6, $8, $10, $12 a month, depending upon what size of service that we have. This is certainly not a lot of money for the amount of cost involved in the cost of a fire protection service and the ready-to-use water that is there for a large fire.
Well, now, this is the thing. You use the water for a large fire when you don't have a sprinkler system. You got a sprinkler system, you don't have the fire. You can't show me one building in Portland that's sprinkled, completely sprinkled, that we've had a major fire.
I can't answer that.
Now, but when we do not have a sprinkler system, then is when we use water. We really pour the water on. When you see on TV and 14, 15 3-inch lines going and 14, 15 2.5-inch lines going, you have to have a water line to use that. But with a sprinkler system, you don't use very much water. This is the principle.
Well, think possibly one may be as important as the other. However, I believe there's not as much opportunity for a loss factor as there is trying to recover part of our cost through a monthly standby charge. It would depend upon the circumstance, I would say.
Do you think over the state, the cost factor would be more important?
I can't speak for the rest of the state. I really don't know that.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Mr. Joe Wagner.
Standby charges for fire service systems. The overall role of the policy of the water utility must be described towards one, planning, providing a water system which is adequate and reliable from a fire protection standpoint for the community. Two, encouraging high-risk properties to assume a portion of the fire protection risk they create by installing private fire service. And three, working cooperatively with all other fire protection and fire prevention agencies and communities, eliminating conditions which cause great loss of life and tremendous economic waste to patients vary every year by fire. Fires are relatively easy to control the properly installed and maintained sprinkler. Furthermore, sprinkler systems are essential in large square buildings because of the difficulty of bringing fire under control from the outside. Public and private protection, there are two facets to this discussion of fire protection cost and water systems. There's a matter of public fire protection systems equally available to all, which involves providing storage, trunk main capacity, properly safe and operated hydrants. Secondly, there is private fire service systems, which require from the water utility adequate storage, surveillance, and fire flows to serve a fire sprinkler system and private fire hydrants. With respect to public fire protection facilities, it is important for us to understand the role of the water utility in providing fire service and to correct the phraseology of time used, which inaccurately portrays the service provided. Water utilities generally receive some form of reimbursement to cover the cost of extra main capacity of additional storage, hydrant maintenance and operation and so forth, all of which are part of the cost of providing fire service. In the case of private fire systems which benefit an individual property or a complex, herein the utility provides the necessary fire flow, storage, capability and maintenance and surveillance of the connection. This represents the furnishing of a personal service not enjoyed by the community in general. There is a measurable benefit which responsibility and logically can be assessed for this service, and one which, in considering the total picture, would not serve to discourage the installation of such a service on private property. Here again, so far as nomenclature is concerned, proper designation for this service, which would be accurately prescriptive, is fire protection service. Responsibility. Authorities generally agree that fire prevention is recognized as being primarily the responsibility of the property owner. The architect, the engineer, have the responsibility to provide adequate fire protection in the building design and the preparation of plans. However, all too often, sprinkler systems and other fire protection measures have been eliminated as an economy measure at the insistence of the property owner, which it was found that the cost of structure would exceed the original estimate of funds available. And in additional area of responsibility yield, and with the handling of relatively large fires, when it comes to joint responsibility of fire and water departments, to place these under control. Water utility functions would include operating of gates, control valves to feed additional water to the area, starting pumps to increase the compression, and generally to be in close contact with the fire officials to render the utmost assistance. Now, control. Customers' private fire protection system should be completely independent of its internal domestic system. There should be no interconnection of these two systems except with the code of systems and specified specific approval of the water purveyor. Proper control can be exercised through measuring of the insulation, B, alarms on the consumer system, and C, periodic inspection. The insulation of meters which are read regularly serve to indicate unauthorized consumption or utilization of the service in a manner which detracts from its primary objective, that of preventing fire. A detector check meter and wall are installed at the expense of the property, thereafter maintained by the utility in providing the fire protection service. This type of insulation is both in the interest of ensuring to the owner and ready availability of fire service for the fire protection, and at the same time tends to monitor on behalf of the utility proper utilization of fire service for the purpose to handle. This type of insulation also serves as one check valve, which would otherwise be necessary in the fire service and at a nominal cost provides protection for both the utility and the customer. Efficacy and reliability. Quality water service must be a goal of all water purveyors if they are to provide proper domestic service and fire protection. A review of fire rating schedules of American Insurance Association indicates important relationships between the ability of water utilities to provide proper fire protection and the grading of a system on its fire protection capabilities. The grading of a city from a fire protection standpoint depends on a number of factors, among which the single factor of greatest weight and importance is the ability and reliability of water systems to provide necessary fire flow. Adequacy of the system may be defined as its ability to provide the required water to at responsible pressure. Reliability can be defined as the capability of a water system to provide adequate water at the proper pressure under all unusual or emergency conditions. As water purveyors, we must constantly strive to build into our system the capability of meeting both the adequacy and reliability criteria in order to ensure the water. The most basic element in fire defense of the city is always one instance called the service. Charges. There appears to be a substantial agreement among water purveyors that a fire protection service provides a special personal service which is not enjoyed by the community in general. Installation of fire protection systems is optional with the property owner because he is the principal benefactor. It is only proper that he pays for the associated expense providing this service. A charge for fire protection should be based on and cover the actual cost of rendering the service rather than the value of fire protection to the user. Considerable adjustments must be utilized in proper allocation charges for this service because it should cover the out-of-pocket cost and yet not be so magnitude as to discourage the installation of prior fire protection systems. Service installation required should be responsible yet consistent with good water works practice. Every water utility must hold itself in readiness and be prepared to meet the demand, paced by declaration to be so prepared. Necessitates large capital investments by the utility together with varying maintenance and operation costs of providing this service, and as this in turn supports the position of the utility in making a reasonable charge for fire protection service. Charges for fire protection service by the utility should be covered out of the pocket cost for special benefits provided. A private fire protection systems necessary because the hazard is created by the owner of the property or is inherent to the business. The courts therefore have ruled that if private fire service confers special benefits for rich and a reasonable charge may be sustained. Water measured through the fire systems. We have prepared spreadsheets for the past 4 years, which consist of water used through private fire protection systems. Had they not been properly installed and metered by provided for, as in the year of 1967, the loss would have been in the amount of 900,600 gallons of water. In the year of 1968, the loss would have been in the amount of 864,960 gallons of water. In 1969, the amount would have been 817,564 gallons of water. And in the year 1970, the amount was 274,516 gallons. The reason for the reduction of water usage through private fire protection systems of 1970 was a constant effort by the water utility informing the private fire protection system that the fact that it was not discontinued, the severe measures would have to be taken and deprive them from their low rate of insurance. The average revenue to the average commercial industrial property as a domestic water use, the yearly contribution in revenue to the water department is far less than the average home facility's contribution to the water system barely pays the expense to render the administration costs. Whereas the homeowner, the bedroom of the industrial, provides the greatest revenue to the water department at the least expense. Actual cost of delivering water. In our audit report ending June 30, 1970, on page 5, of which the Secretary of State has a copy, will show that the average delivery cost of 100 cubic feet of water, exclusive of depreciation, is 0.2234%. The district supply is 0.1634. Purchase of Bull Run water is 0.1243. The average operational delivery cost per service is $40.71 a year. District supply is $29.78. And the purchase of Bull Run water supply is 62.02. Bill 1115, section 4, line 28 to 29 imposes a restriction of a charge not to exceed $24. This charge does not dictate the average cost of delivered water through a 3/4 inch service per year. Bond indebtedness. Parkwood Water District sold $50,000 worth of bonds in 1936 when the district was a small commercial and industrial area, residential area. The district operated 30 years without selling any general obligations, but from 1961 and in the past 10 years, with the industrial coming into the area, the Parkwood Water District was forced to sell in 1966 $350,000 worth of bonds plus $200,000 for the general fund and a federal grant of $85,050 to build storage facilities, a 24-inch transmission line, a pump station, to meet fire demands created by industries coming into the area, which burdened the homeowner for the greatest share of the bond issue. Even with the minimum standby charge and the meter device in use at the present time, for monetary and private fire protection systems will never reimburse the water supply, supplier, or the homeowner for a capital outlay. The water repair purveyor makes every effort and invests in large capital outlays. Private corporations to enjoy private protection system, fire protection system at a lower insurance rate at a minimum cost of $3 the diameter intra-pipe per month. It's one of the lowest utility rates in their operation. House Bill 1115, section line 3, section 3, line 20 and 24, is a water flow alarm device. Checking with Viking Sprinkler Company, this type of device does not detect small flows of water. There could be conditions when 10 gallons a minute pass through an 8-inch line and not activate the alarm. That equals to 600 gallons an hour, 14,400 gallons a day, or 525,600 gallons a year. An estimate installation cost of the device is $500. Who's going to perform the maintenance? Fire department? fire alarm signal to fire station. Action Fire Alarm Signal Company, which provides a service to private fire protection system customers. Represented by Mr. Frank, was in our office on February 18, 1971, and made a statement that most of their devices are set for a 5-pound pressure drop and a 16-second delay before a signal is sent out. A 5-pound pressure drop in a 1-inch pipeline does not contaminate a very large flow of water. But in an 8-inch pipeline with 100 pounds of pressure, it will deliver 400 gallons a minute to drop the pressure 5 pounds to evacuate that alarm or signal. This could constitute a water loss of 24,000 gallons an hour. This device installation is estimated at $700 and a monthly service charge of $50 per month to the private person. Comments, we are at loss as why House Bill 1150 was introduced. People of private sprinkler systems had no complaints as to the fire department.
Where does unauthorized loss of water come to into effect from? In a sprinkler system?
Comes from cross connection, sir. Fire hose station, cross connection, pumps and power lines.
No, we're talking about a sprinkler system.
That's what I'm talking about. This is what I'm talking about. They would have to lease our service into a sprinkler system.
But when a sprinkler system is installed,
right,
then the only time you get a loss is when a sprinkler goes
down.
Where do you get it?
Because management needs well, but not the employees who get it. The plumber goes in and he keeps the pipeline, what does he do? Tap. As long as there's water in that pipeline. He just doesn't care whether it's on a fire service or whether it's on a domestic service.
But I worked for years in the Portland Fire Department, and the only time that we ever had a run was when a defective sprinkler system or the alarm turned in when the water begins to flow. And most of them were sprinkler heads that went out.
That's very true, because when the sprinkler head is on, it starts maybe from an 8-inch line, and it goes anywhere from 2 inches to 1 inch and down
but,
to 3/4 inch.
But the only water that they use is that one sprinkler head.
No, it isn't. I can't go along with you. I have spreadsheets, and I can show you water being used. Now, we read these meters every month, and we charge those people. And we're not talking about figures of 900,000 gallons to a fire system.
What else? After we had that business.
Now let me explain this. We had some that 4 months straight, they run anywhere from 100 cubic feet, then they increase 200, 500, 600 cubic feet. And we finally tell them, look, buddy, this is the end. Now you either get off of the fire system or we're turning off that system. The next month we're to zero. Now you answer to me, where do they take the water?
In a sprinkler system.
In the sprinkler system, because that's the only device we meter in this
country. Well, let's take another line. After this same bill was introduced last year, 2 years ago, did Park Rose lower their rates?
No, we did not lower the rates. We took the demand off. We paid to another utility prior to that.
You did what?
So we took the demand off because we were supplying our own water. That we paid for another utility to be part of them. You're referring to the $41 against $30.
What happened?
Because we ended up paying the city of Portland demand for every fire service. We supply our own water, 30% of our own system. We do not contribute that demand to the city of Portland.
Well, would you agree that we should have uniform rates?
Uniform rates without any restrictions, so they can be created according to the cost of the day of living, like any other utility, like cell phone companies, light companies, gas companies. They all got 5 to 10% increase in rates.
But when we on a sprinkler system, would you agree that we could work out some agreement on a uniform charge in the water service?
I think it's pretty hard, a uniform charge throughout the state. Because installing a water system is not like going out there and start pulling cables on a light pole or on an electric pole. It's all going to be a little bit different.
I'd like to come to Park Rose and see how you operate your water district. If a sprinkler system uses water and has a waste of water, I would like to come out sometime and have you show me where it is.
You're welcome anytime. I don't go in the buildings to show where they're at. I just inform the private sprinkler system that we either have to get off or we just close the system. They enjoy insurance rates, the most lowest insurance rate they can by a private system, right? Am I correct there?
A sprinkler system, yeah.
Right. But the average homeowner can't enjoy that rate.
You could if you wanted to still install a sprinkler system.
Would you buy a home to install a sprinkler system?
If it would have the value to it, yes.
Would have the value? Let's not get into it.
Yeah. I think that...
Because if there was a building rule that every house would be have a sprinkler system, I don't know what we need fire departments for. All we need is an extra staff of the water department to turn the water off after the fire is put out.
Well,
that's about as logical as it is. I mean, I just can't buy it, put the one against the other.
I agree with you on the use of the water from a sprinkler system. I'd have to have somebody show it to me.
I don't know how to do it. I have 4 years of spreadsheets right here. We bill them every month.
Well, I can see if they have a fire.
No, they don't need a fire. Just the last convention of AWWA, Nancy Andrews was telling me, Rose Creek, the pressure dropped. He went down to see it, and what did the guy do? Mill Pond was down, so he hooked a 6-inch fire line onto his sprinkler system in the building, in the mill, and filled the pool. All they do is turn the alarms off. That's a big joke, the fire alarm. They pull the fuses, 6-inch line, go into the pool, fill it so the logs are close to the mill.
Well,
you
further questions? Thank you. You're welcome. Laverne Carey.
I would like to ask Mr. Price this one.
Oh, Mr. Wagner, let's... My name is Laverne Carey, and I'm representing the Oregon Fire Marshals Association, and I am a fire marshal, and in my capacity, I find myself attempting to sell people on the installation of sprinkler systems to protect their property. And we're not always talking about a big structure. We don't happen to enjoy a basement sprinkler ordinance in my city. And I'd like to just give you one example of a person who owns 3 major buildings in the downtown area. I approached him on the idea of sprinklering the basement. So if we have an alarm there, the sprinklers are going to take care of the fire, at least the basement fire, which, as you are probably aware, is the most difficult type of fire to fight. The sprinklers will take care of it. You won't have the big logs. We won't have the exposure of risk to firemen. We won't use the thousands of gallons of water that we would use doing it manually. This man was agreeable, up to the point when he found out that he was going to pay $1 per inch for the water connection. In other words, the 4-inch connection is going to pay $4 a month, and that he's going to have to pay for a large meter pit, and he's going to have to pay for a meter. Going to be many hundreds of dollars. And his response was, why should I pay a penalty to put in those sprinklers that is going to save the city thousands of gallons of water, save the beating to the fire department, keep my property on the tax rolls, keep my employees in money for food and shelter, and the man next to me, who absolutely refuses to cooperate by protecting his property, gets by scot-free. Why should I pay the penalty? Now, we've heard a man here say that provision of water for a sprinkler system, and I'll attempt to quote as closely as possible, but you understand this without context, is a personal service not enjoyed by the community as a whole. Fire service doesn't agree with this. It is something that is enjoyed by the community as a whole. Because if we can keep properties operating, keep them on the tax rolls, keep the employees working, then the community is the richer for this effort. The property owner is not the only principal benefactor. The community is the benefactor for this private service. We're penalizing the wrong man. The example was used of a large warehouse, and I'm going to try to quote as closely as possible some of the examples of why this cost standby charge should be made. There's a cost of the system to meet the demand, the water flow demand. The size of the main must be large or larger than the required water use. And in the problem of unauthorized water use, all these build up and make great costs to the utility. And I agree, they do make great costs to the utility, and we're not questioning that at all. But I'm wondering what would happen if that warehouse had not been required to sprinkler and they didn't put in a sprinkler system. All of these costs for the water main are going to be expended by that utility anyhow. And I think it's unreasonable to believe that that utility is going to get it back with a monthly standby charge. And again, this warehouse isn't the principal benefactor. It's the community as a whole that is going to benefit from the installation of that sprinkler system that keeps that property from having a serious fire. Much of what I would have said, I suppose, has been brought out by Representative Howard in his questioning. And I think that our position really is that we're just plain penalizing the wrong person. If we're going to penalize, let's penalize the man with a standby charge for the water that's out here in a hydrant, where someone's going to have to lay 200 to 1,000 feet of hose to get that water from that hydrant up to the building. And then let's penalize him for paying those firemen that are going to have to take that water by hose down a basement stairway, which is acting as a flue, and get that water delivered onto that fire. And let's not penalize the man who puts out his own fire. Senator, would you like to come up now?
Chairman, members, I'm Glenn Sadler, representing Eugene Water and Electric Board, and I appreciate the opportunity as a freshman lobbyist to make my first presentation before your committee. I've been around here about 15 years, but this is the first time I've been on this side of the microphone. I'm only going to make two points, Mr. Chairman, and if there are questions, I would prefer to take notes on them and get answers from the boss, as I told you, I'm just starting out as an assistant. 2 years ago, we opposed a bill, it was House Bill 1686, for the same reason that we are today opposing House Bill 1115, with all due respect to my very good friend and sponsor, whom I served many years. The first is that this is an effective proposal, we think, for the state of Oregon to establish rates charged by a municipally owned utility for services rendered by its customers. And two, we are opposed to House Bill 1115 because we do not extend the utility service to our customers without making a charge for that service. Now, the City of Eugene, the charter, gives authority to the Eugene Water and Electric Board to establish rates and charges for services rendered. This is done under our Home Rule Charter power. Our flat rate for fire protection applies only where the service is not metered. It is a charge of 80 cents a month per inch of pipe or $3.20 a month for a 4-inch pipe. We request that we be permitted to render this service and set the rate as to be charged under our charter, under our rules and regulations, and not by the State of Oregon under House Bill 1115. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Howard.
Glenn, would you mind checking with your outfit and getting about five or six buildings that are stapled in the Eugene area, and let me know what the standby charges are.
For each building?
What you charge each
building. These would be, you require representative buildings throughout the city.
I'm sure that there are various buildings around Eugene that are sprinkled, and what their charges are. I don't think Eugene's one of the real out-of-line water companies, if I remember right. I'd like to know.
I'd be very happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. Are there any other further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. That is all.
No, I've got another young fellow here that's poking his head up here.
John Guerin, the utilities director for the city of Salem, his testimony at the earlier portion of the public hearing a week ago last Monday. And also, I would like to call your attention to a communication from the manager of the Coos Bay North Bend Water Board that will be coming to the committee probably tomorrow. In opposition to the House Bill 1115 also. A couple of points came up in the discussion here that I might comment on. I'd like to point out that the water utilities don't disagree, of course, with the need for fire protection sprinkler systems. They are needed, but we don't feel that they should be at the expense of the revenue base of the water utilities themselves. The vast majority of the utilities, especially in the state of Oregon, are operated not through any tax structure or any property taxes. They're operated just like your telephone system or electric utilities. They're based on revenue, and the rates are established by virtue of the cost of doing business. The other question that came up was the point by Representative Howard regarding the diminishment of the need for water because of the existence of sprinkler systems. The American Insurance Association, formerly the Board of Fire Underwriters, do not recognize in any way the lessening of fire demands and the need for the ability to decrease main size because fire protection systems exist. The fire capability, water delivery capability, has to remain at the level required by the AIA, regardless of the existence of a sprinkler system or not. So sprinkler systems, in effect, do not affect whatsoever the capabilities required for the delivery of water. The third point I'd like to call attention to is this uniform cost that you mentioned. I don't think it's practical because the cost of doing business varies so much from utility to utility. It's probably three times as expensive to lay a water main in the lava rock of Bend than it is to the alluvial soils of Salem. But for this reason, I don't think we can approach anything close to a uniform cost. However, there's possibility for movement in that direction by virtue of the rate base for fire services now being used. The rate base varies from utility to utility. The lowest charges reflect only the cost of maintaining that fire service, maintaining that detector check, and reading the whatever meters or other facilities involved with fire protection systems. They range from that low price all the way up to the utility. That was the case in the White City industrial area in Medford, where the total cost of this water system is being amortized by fire protection standby charges, because this is the sole purpose of the water system itself. So I think this rate base being the criteria used for the establishment of fire protection standby charges is different. I think there is room for close and uniformity, but the cost of doing business just plain vary in different parts of the state. For that reason, I don't think we want to establish such a uniform charge.
Mr. Howard.
This is what I'm trying to say, was that if I have a building, you weigh the water hydrants, no matter whether there's a sprinkler in that building or not. You weigh the water hydrants to the building.
Not necessarily.
Whether the guy's going to put in a sprinkler system or not. Then if he runs a line to a sprinkler system, the water's already out there and it's maintained 24 hours a day, 365 days out of the year. But the sprinkler system is the protection for society and the public as well as that building. Because every time the sprinkler puts out a fire, that's just that much less and better insurance rates you have every time a building sprinkled. But a national underwriter, of course, wouldn't specify a sprinkler, but they give all the credit in the world to a sprinkler system as far as putting out a fire. This is more of a public service by a water bureau. And in your experience here in Salem, or in your friends, can you tell me one building that was completely sprinkled that was totally destroyed by fire?
No, but that doesn't make any difference in the cost of providing the capability.
You've got the water right there. You've got
we've
the
got hydrant. A lot of the capability to provide it.
And now, in maintenance of the sprinkler system, they'll be, well, in this state capital downstairs here.
Absolutely. There are definitely cases where fire protection systems in themselves, in addition to the fire hydrant supply or any other requirements of the area, call for a greater need and greater sizing of fire or water distribution systems. No question about it. I can.
For a sprinkler system?
Yeah, I can see numerous cases in which this has occurred. Where is Robert Hyle is the head of the city of Portland who is playing.
Where is any place that you need more water to run a sprinkler system than you do 10 hydrants?
Well, I can only cite specific buildings here in Salem, but the obvious case is the White City system in Medford. The only capability the water system has is for fire protection, and the only need is for fire protection. And therefore, the whole rate base is based on fire protection standby charges. This is the case with all other utilities, only to a varying degree.
But you've laid the water right to the building, no matter what, because you have to put the hydrants down.
In the street. We don't put fire hydrants on private property.
But you put them in the street.
Yeah.
And then it's a short run to the building.
But the fire protection system can create more demand than the fire hydrants themselves. There's no question about it.
I'd like to see some facts and figures on that. If any water bureau can back that up, I'd like to see it where a sprinkler system takes more than hydrants.
No question.
It takes about 25 gallons a minute to run a sprinkler, and with a 2.5-inch line or a hydrant.
25 gallons a minute? Any fire hydrant, fire sprinkler system for a building, probably the average, requires 1,000 gallons a minute capability. Capability, I'm not talking about what they use, but I'm talking about what we have to provide for the possibility that they might use. That's what we're concerned with, not how much water they use, what we have to assume that they might use.
Well, you're running How big a line to a fire hydrant?
6 inches.
How big a line do you run into the building?
Well, anywhere from 2-inch fire service all the way up to 12-inch fire service.
Into a sprinkler system?
Sure. With food, so they look 10-inch.
That's all.
Joel, for the record, I am the chair of the was placed on our registration list. We can know that. Thank you very much. Close the hearing on House Bill 1115. Open the hearing on House Bill 1163. Call first on State Representative Herman Mann. Up in the high country. Somewhere around the Minor River. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What bill are we on?
House Bill 1163. Chairman, I'm sure you'll all agree with me that it's desirable to have first-class labor camp facilities in this state.
Excuse me, Mr. Mayor. Always shut that door.
Labor camp facilities in this state for two reasons, and one of them, of course, is to keep seasonal influx of labor into towns where they automatically go into substandard facilities, or else to keep our seasonal influx of labor out of substandard facilities that are outside of the city and are old and outmoded. I was startled to find out, and I'll explain to you just briefly, that this bill was exempt from normal ad valorem property taxes, first class, cooperatively owned labor camp facilities which meet the stringent regulations of the health department, the fire marshal, and the fire marshal. So they're safe and they're clean and up to standard in all respects. Now, I was startled to find out in this instance that labor camps, foreign labor camps, are taxed as motels are taxed. And this means several things, but among other things, it means that their personal property is taxed. The washing machines, the dryers, the dishwashers that they have on, the mattresses, the chairs, everything that's movable is taxed, as a hotel is taxed. Now, I have checked the Department of Revenue that told me that the only one of these facilities that would meet this requirement is in my county in Milton Freewater, but I don't agree with the Department of Revenue. I'm certain that there's one in Wasco County, there's one in, and Bob Davis tells me there's one in Jackson County, and I think there are one or two others in the state, but in any event, the one that I have observed is in Milton Freewater, and it is a facility that is this cost about $200,000. It was built with federal aid on a long-term loan basis. It's owned by a nonprofit corporation of farmers. It's a beautiful facility, and one of the ungodly most sophisticated in the state. The property taxes on it are $6,000 a year. Now, this particular facility the facility just doesn't make that kind of money enough to pay that kind of property taxes. In addition to that, they have their streets, as an example, are river rock, and every once in a while a rotter goes down the street and blasts a window out. All right, the answer to that is to pave the streets. But if they pave the streets, they raise their property taxes a great deal more, and so they're in a bind, as would any other facility like this be. And this is, I'm sure, as I say, you agree, a desirable facility. So what this bill does is that on page 2, line 6, provides that a defined eligible daycare center, which is operated by a nonprofit corporation. Line 10 defines an eligible farm labor camp operated by a nonprofit corporation, complying with the health code of the state for farm labor camps. Line 13 through 16 defines the rental as the net amount of income from the eligible daycare center or the eligible farm labor camp after deductions of costs attributable to utilities, garbage disposal, repairs, and replacement of fixtures and furniture. And then in section 3, which is the controlling section, in lieu of real and personal property taxes, each nonprofit corporation eligible for a tax exemption under this act will pay an amount equal to 10% of the rentals as defined in sub 3 of section 1. Now, the impact of this in this particular instance would be this. It now pays about $6,000 property taxes in the Milton Free Water Camp, and it would, its property taxes would be in lieu of taxes, would be about $2,000, which it could, the camp could live with very well. Before I go on to the rest of the bill, I want to point out, for just as an example, a camp like this should change its mattresses once every 3 years. That means that this particular camp should buy about 65 mattresses a year. Having to pay in order to just be a healthy, clean, decent place to live, for people to live. And this particular camp couldn't possibly do that kind of thing if so long as they have to pay this kind of property taxes. For the purpose of the collection of the in lieu of property taxes under lines 29 to 31 of the bill would be a lien on the property if they're not paid. The top of page 3, sub 4 would provide that the money paid in lieu of would be distributed in the amount to the taxing districts in the county in the same proportion as their levy bears to all real and personal property taxes levied in the state. Section 4 of the nuts and bolts tells the nonprofit corporation how to file for the exemption. Sub 2 of Section 4 provides for the safety and the health factor that I spoke of. That is, and then down in sub 2 and 3 of Section 5, it provides that for a checkoff by the assessor with the state fire marshal to see if the fire laws are being complied with, and a checkoff of the local health officer to see if the health requirements are being complied with. And finally, on page 4, under sub 4, lines 3 through 8, it refers to an eligible daycare center, which is really a necessary adjunct to a farm labor camp. It has to be also certified by the Public Welfare Division as to to be sure that it complies with whatever regulations that agency has before it can qualify for the property tax relief. I have discussed this with the Bob Davis from the governor's office, and he's in Washington, D.C., or I didn't know he would be here, and he's indicated that the governor supported this kind of program. And I think that I would urge your committee to act favorably upon this bill, because I think this is a step in the right direction to provide, to enable people to voluntarily go together on a nonprofit basis and provide really first-class housing for migrant farm labor. And I'm sure that that's the route that we want farm labor housing to take, a collective sort of provisions rather than each individual farmer attempting to provide housing which is almost certain to be substandard. And it would also correct what I consider a real deficiency in our laws, where you tax, levy a property tax on a farm labor camp, a nonprofit farm labor camp, on the same basis as you do a motel.
Mantell.
Yeah.
Questions for Representative Mann? Mr. McPherson.
Is this trying to encourage the formation of on property among the migrants in the south building here?
I don't know whether we encourage them to do that or not. I don't see any reason for that.
Well, as the farmer who now gives his migrant labor to provide a home for them, what's the intent? He would take that section of his property and sell it off into a non-profit corporation?
The intent is, if you have a group of farmers in an area, which you are always do in this area, for instance, all the bean growers out in this direction decided it's very desirable for farmers to provide housing for their farm labor. And the intent is to encourage them to get together on this cooperative basis and build really good first-class structures and new structures and make it so they can afford to build them on a cooperative, collective basis.
But a single farmer I'm not saying this is bad. Yeah. To chalk off a portion of the premises dedicated to migrant housing, form a non-profit corporation, transfer this to it.
That's right.
And then he would be exempt.
If he complies with all of the regulations of the state fire marshal, and if he complies with all the sanitary regulations of the health department.
But he...
There would be nothing bad about
somewhere
that.
Somewhere else would have to work, and then he gets the rent for nothing, but he doesn't, because it's a non-profit corporation. He can't use proceeds for gain.
So not at all.
You'd have that protection.
That's right.
Okay.
Further questions?
One question.
Mr. Howard.
Before the Public Welfare Division would give a verification, they have to, the Board of Health tells them that it meets the standard. Is there
you
a
bet.
Fine.
You bet. I would share with the committee just a second. It's really an experience to go to one of these daycare centers right at the height of the harvest. See, they have it from that size on up, you know. Just a sea of children in there. And it's a really illuminating experience.
Any impact estimates on this?
Yes, sir. As I say, this particular one, which in my county, which is undoubtedly the biggest and most expensive one in the state at this point, is the impact would be a loss of about $4,000 in revenue to Umatilla County. I think, as I said, there's one in Wasco County, and I think Bob Davis indicated there's one in Jackson County, and maybe one or two others. But the biggest loss would be in that one in my own county.
$4,000 loss revenue total county levy, not to the county, you think? Or are you saying that $4,000 loss to the county itself?
Well, total county. Yeah. The total property taxes that nonprofit corporation pays is six, and it will probably be something like two in lieu of.
All right.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Representative Walden.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Representative Paul Walden, representing Hood River and Wasco County. The Wasco Fruit and Produce League has for a number of years operated such a camp as the one that would come under the provisions of this bill. The Fruit and Produce League is a nonprofit corporation which exactly fits the terms of the bill, and their farm labor camp is to the point where they are considering building a brand new facility in another location. There are problems with the location of their plant. They want to run some streets through here and further develop the surrounding property, plus the fact they need to do some rebuilding. I do not have any idea of what they're doing tax-wise now on the present one, because for them, on their behalf, we're looking only at a projection, and that is that they have been considering building a plant that would meet all the standards that are set forth in this bill. So on their behalf, I would like to suggest that the committee consider it very seriously and vote favorably for this particular bill. These gentlemen that I talked to indicated that if they could get this type of tax relief, they doubtless would proceed in the very near future with the construction. As far as tax impact on a new facility, of course, it would have no particular effect on the county. I think they're probably going to have to tear this one down. I don't think they can possibly bring it up to standard. The new facility they built would build would be starting with bare land and going from there, so it would be something that's never been on the tax roll anyway. And having operated an orchard for 10 years in Wasco County, certainly recognize the need for this type of facility and this type of tax relief in order to achieve it.
Question, Mr. Wolf. Dan, how does talks about eligible daycare centers in here. How does the recent federal pieces of legislation and future ones affect these daycare centers? Is there any relevance to I think it becomes a title of a recent act, the Social Security Act, to have dealt with daycare centers and upcoming legislation to deal with daycare centers. How would these areas be affected?
Well, Representative Denfor, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure because in Wasco County they have not operated a daycare center. This is strictly a cherry picking operation. It comes in usually mid-June to July 1st in that area for maybe 3 weeks. We don't have the picking problem of people when the school is in session and so on. So they have not operated a daycare center per se. They have had some child-type programs held right within the camp, so I'm not qualified to discuss the daycare center impact.
Mr. Mann, did you want to answer further than
the answer to the question is yes. There are federal funds, and they have to be matched by a certain percentage by the local people. And the percentage cannot be in kind. It has to be in cash. And I think the percentage is 25%. And once that is maxed, then this particular daycare center, if they can find $25,000 between now and the 1st of April, why they will get $75,000 in federal matching to operate for the year.
Could I ask another question? Would such a daycare center be possible without the legislation?
Oh, certainly. But this legislation, as I understand it also, I think daycare centers may be exempt from taxation, from property taxation. So this daycare center that I'm talking about just happens to be owned by this facility.
How about property generally as a nonprofit corporation? Did it exist or did it come up? What is the exemption when it's granted?
The property is not exempt. It's taxed on an ad valorem basis.
Even if it's organized for charitable purposes?
For what kind of purposes?
Well, charitable or any illusionary or. Or educational?
No. Daycare center? It's entirely possible that daycare center could qualify without this bill, but the camp itself can't in the category you're speaking of
without this bill.
Chairman, members of the committee. Professor Cannon, Assistant to Governor McCall for Natural Resources. I'm here in support of House Bill 1163. A couple of points that I would like to make. First of all, the concept that we have of the bill is a concept that this is a legitimate way in which to go to encourage the level of housing that we want for our migrant people. It seems to me and to us that by giving this type of incentive, we move ahead in securing the better housing, the higher standard housing that certainly we want for migrants. Second point is simply that the 10% has a background in existing practice, and the idea of taking 10% of the return or receipt from such a facility ties in with the federal low-cost housing now, which is similarly based upon a 10% of the income that is being received that sets the basis for the rental that is charged. The case and points that Representative Mann has spoken to in regard to the housing facility that he's so familiar with is one, of course, that's been called to our attention many, many times, and it seems highly unfair that a facility that is developed and has been put up for that purpose and that operates for a limited time of year, that is one of the facilities that is pointed to with a great deal of pride by those people who are concerned with migrant housing, should be one that at the same time is penalized very heavily by the property tax. On that basis, we support the bill and we hope for favorable action.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Moore?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Earl Moore, legislative chairman of the Oregon State Range. And we support this legislation. We believe that when it comes to farm labor housing, most people seem to think that this is only an agricultural problem, but we think that it's a social problem more than it is an agricultural problem. So anything that can be done to promote better housing for farm workers should be done, and we believe this is a good approach to it. And to go a little farther along that line, we in Oregon give tax advantages to large industries to build pollution control facilities. And why do we do this? Because as a state, we're putting on regulations and restrictions on their operations. Well, when the state tells the farmer out here that he has to build a certain type of housing if he's going to house farm workers, they're doing the same thing. They're saying that these housing units have to come up to a certain level, that they have to pass inspections by the Department of Health and so on. So it seems to us that it's only fair that some tax advantage be given to farm labor housing. And I'd go a little farther than this bill does and say that our organization is on record in favor of the tax advantage to individual growers if they build farm labor housing that will come up to the specification of the state and the health department. Again, we say we think that this is just fair treatment for agriculture.
There might be some reason to challenge that statement, because this, as Mr. Moore said, is more a social question than it is a revenue question.
I'd like to, if you would point out,
I'm going to get a systematic insurgent this morning, it's the judiciary.
our place.
You're not a women's liver?
Well, I'm scared. My name is Vera Kent, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. And I represent a coalition of organizations that have committed themselves to support farm worker legislation. Some have committed themselves 2 years ago, others who were committed this time around. If the spirit of the bill is to commit the individual grower to improve and provide, quote, first class, unquote, housing, farm labor camp housing for the seasonal or migrant workers, we certainly can support it, but we have some strong and serious reservations. First, I'd like to raise some questions relating to the bill.
Can you tell me, I make notes on my bill, pardon me, interrupting you, who's for and who's against now? Who do you represent? Do you represent an organization?
It's a coalition of organizations under the umbrella of Alianza, an alliance of groups. You want to show the name of the organization?
So Alianza,
some of the questions relating to the bill that I have are following. One, who and how is the rental policy to be set? And is it realistic to assume that the farm worker can pay that particular fee? Two, what does the farmer do with the leftover profit after returning the 10% of his net rental to the tax assessor? Is this money then go back to pay the mortgage or the repairs of the camp, of the farm camp? If a nonprofit corporation is dissolved, what happens to the land and the buildings on the property owned by the corporation? Doesn't the farmer, by his rental fee, pay off the possible mortgage or the repair bill and establish certain assets for the corporation when the corporation is dissolved? Four, House Bill 1163, as it stands now, can apply to any camp presently in operation, rather than to construct new camps. Is it not possible for three people to establish a corporation at this present time on a present farm camp housing and be eligible for this bill? For instance, an attorney, the wife, or the husband, to run their own camp. Would it be possible for three or four people to establish a nonprofit corporation? For instance, an attorney and a grower, or the wife of the grower, the mother, or the father, or any member of the family. And then when the corporation is dissolved, what happens to the assets of the corporation? Does it turn right back to the farmer itself? I'm raising these questions. I suspect that I have some of the answers, but I really don't know that much about corporate law. The bill also discusses the state fire marshal. When I spoke to Mr. Sandigan of the Board of Health, he questioned the fact whether we have state fire laws or that some counties have any fire laws and regulations. I asked that question to this committee. Do we have state or county fire laws? Six. Why is the local health officer the only one involved in certification of compliance? I would like to see other agency representatives who are currently involved in camp inspection, either the Bureau of Labor or Division of Employment, to also be responsible for certification of compliance. Seven. In section 6, you talk about an appeal to the Department of Revenue. What does it mean? Any taxpayer aggrieved by any decision under this act may appeal to the Department of Revenue. What kind of procedures have been established? Can the farm worker appeal to the Department of Revenue? What kind of procedures does he have? Does he have any right of appeal? Eight. Some questions as to tenants' rights, if they in fact do pay rent. will visitors be allowed on the camp to visit the farm workers? As you may be very well aware, in the last couple of years, there have been several arrests on farm camps when people from the Valley Migrant League or other agencies came onto the camp to assist some of the farm workers living there. And if they do pay rent, then will they be allowed to have visitors? What right does the, question nine, what rights does the state have in relation to the right to inspection? As the law stands now, farmers or growers can refuse inspectors to come onto their property. We have a bill now that will give the state of Oregon, House Bill 1047, will authorize issuance of a warrant for inspection. At this time, they can refuse an inspector or local health officer to enter the camp. This is happening in Hood River in about 5 or 6 camps. Most of the farmers have complied and allowed inspectors to enter the camps, but according to the law, they do not have. The main problems, though, are those of our current enforcement policy and our current state standards. And let me refer first to the problems of enforcement. According to Oregon law, it does not require health officers to enter camps for the purpose of inspection and enforcement of codes. So that's the first problem. Second problem is inspection of farm labor camps and facilities are not required by law. There is nothing in the statute that says that any camp or all camps have to be inspected. Now, water supply does have to be inspected, but the camp itself doesn't unless somebody makes a complaint. The Board of Health found in 1969, out of roughly 863 camps, 165 camps that opened and failed to meet the standards and remained open. 42 camps were never even inspected and stayed open. This is a kind of an enforcement policy. No, I do not feel that any farm labor camp should be exempt, any tax exemption, under these kinds of conditions. 43% of all the camps in 1969 either didn't meet the standards or were never inspected.
Mr. Chairman.
Are you through?
No, I'm not.
This bill only covers 3 camps in the state of Oregon that we know of. Now, we aren't even discussing all the ramifications that you're discussing in this bill. There's only 3 camps. They have to be non-profit corporations, and most of them are religious, I think. I don't know. I think most of them are religious. Foreign groups and religious people. You're talking about something that isn't even in this bill. You're talking about all the labor camps in Oregon.
I'm talking about those camps too. I'm talking all about the labor camps in Oregon.
These have to be approved by the State Board of Health.
Yes, that's right. And
they have to be inspected by the State Fire Marshal.
That's right. But my point is, first, that anybody can establish a corporation if this law passes, if this bill becomes law. That those 3 camps...
If they become a non-profit corporation.
They sure can. You get 3 or 4 people can establish a non-profit corporation, charge rent on a facility, return 10% of the net rental cost, take the rest of the money and pay off the mortgage or pay off the repair bill. There's no profit involved for profit per se. Okay. But the problem, even if we're talking about three camps, the problem of enforcement in our housing standards applies to those three camps. We also have no plan of correction for any violation that is found on the camp. It's at the discretion of a local health officer whether a facility is closed or whether a camp is closed. The only person that can close a camp is a local health officer. Bureau of Labor representatives can close a facility. The local health officer can rescind the closing notice after 24 hours. But there's nothing in the law that says that a camp has to be closed. It may close, may be closed. So what are the results? The results are what I said before. That 43% of the camps are operating without meeting the standards. There's also a political problem that's involved here. The local health officers are appointed behind by county commissioners of the county who are elected by the growers and the farmers of that county if that county is a farming county. So you can see there's a little conflict of interest. And in talking to them, they feel that their hands are tied and that there is a problem in terms of enforcing the law. Now let me get now to the last point I want to make, and probably the most crucial is that our standards today are lower than the standards set by the federal government and are lower than the standards set by our neighboring states of Washington, California, and Idaho. We do not have to supply mattresses, as was mentioned in previous testimony. We also don't have any standards for number of washing machines, just laundry facilities. I can run down the list on what we're deficient in, and we rate very low in relationship to the federal government or to the three neighboring states. And I think before we give any tax exemption to farm labor camps, we certainly should consider the raising of our own standards so that we can establish a uniform standard for the Pacific Northwest states, so that we can maintain a good labor supply in the state of Oregon and provide decent housing. I hope that you gentlemen received this report, and Table 10 on page 66 to 68 does a rather fine summary of the standards for the three states and the federal government as compared to the ones in Oregon. In effect, under this bill, the farm worker not only subsidizes the agricultural industry by being excluded from minimum wage, unemployment, collective bargaining, and other labor bills, but are now in effect subsidizing the farmer by being charged a rent, and we as taxpayers in turn are subsidizing the farmer to perpetuate a rather antiquated farm labor system. I am personally opposed to on-farm camp labor camp housing. This law favors the farmer overwhelmingly. Until some of the questions that we raise are answered, and until the present enforcement standards are clearly defined, clearly established, until our health and code standards are upgraded to meet those of our neighboring states or those of the federal government, I'm not only as a representative of this coalition, but as a taxpayer, strongly recommend a no pass recommendation from this group. Thank you.
General wonder, you indicated at the beginning a kind of sympathy toward the intent of the bill.
Yes.
And I would assume the coalition feels the same way.
Yes.
Do you think it would be possible, or have you considered drawing amendments to it that might make it an acceptable bill?
It is very possible for some of us to sit down and consider. I'd like to have the input, though, from the sponsors of the bill as well as people from our group. just for the record, 2 years ago, we did sponsor a bill that would give the farmer and the grower tax credit. And that bill was defeated. It was in the taxation committee when Representative Hart was chairman. Not right offhand, but I certainly can.
Concerned a little bit about farm labor in Oregon and other states. You would have to admit, of course, that they are a low income group. They told me that, and your testimony today tells me that. Is that right?
Yes.
So if we don't pass some laws by which housing can be made better, me that there is no law which requires the farmer to provide housing. And if he goes completely out of the business, that forces low income people into higher cost housing, or they don't come at all.
Right.
In which case, they're again replaced by a machine.
Right.
And that seems to me to be what's happening.
That's good.
Every time I turn around, there's a new machine that has been developed to reap a harvest. And the answer that's given is that the necessity is the mother of invention. And the necessity is comes out because of demand and the increased cost of labor and so forth. And I wonder sometimes if you don't work against it. I don't know.
Well, the necessity for mechanization has come about because of increased costs for fertilizer and other chemicals and feed, including farm labor. Farm labor is probably the lowest cost. And He has to, in some areas, mechanize. Unfortunately, the small farmer, because of the price cost squeeze, has to go out of business. I hate to see that happen, but this is what's happening in all other industries. And the threat that's been used for the farm worker all these years is, don't ask too much from us, because we'll mechanize. And the feeling in 1969 and 1970 is, well, go ahead and mechanize. Because we're tired of, in reality, subsidizing you by keeping our wages down and by it. Okay.
That's a fair statement. If you really don't care, then, you know, it's no problem. My argument goes up to I thought the jobs were important to you.
They are important to the people. The way they can survive, but at what price?
Well, at what price in my county? I keep going back to that. You know, I come from a family of itinerant fruit pickers. Some young man was here a while back and said something about what a poor person was, and he got mad, you know. And I had a pair of boots on that day, and he said, a poor person is someone who doesn't have a $65 pair of boots. Well, I've been out in the field too, you know, and my folks before me lived in tents. And they picked, I don't know what they picked, but I remember my mother telling me about the days when all they had was a tent to live in, and it was damn windy. And they were glad to do it. They weren't, they were just poor white trash, that's all. That's the only way they could make a living. I'm wondering what these people are going to do if they say, go ahead and make it. A lot of them are uneducated. Where do they go? What does society do with them then?
Well, I think society has a certain responsibility to start looking at what we do with our underemployed manpower, and has a responsibility to establish jobs in a rural area or in the urban area, to retrain and to re-educate these people so that they don't get on the welfare rolls, and so that they can maintain a decent living wage and live a decent life. And I don't think our government, the state or federal government, has really taken a realistic approach. And we're not only talking about farm workers now. We're talking about a lot of other people in industries that are underemployed.
But in this bill, we're just talking about migrant labor.
That's right.
Just other than I appreciate it. I mean, I would hate to see us, if we can all pretty much agree on the intent of the bill, being perhaps something that should be explored. I would hate to see us make a decision one way or another too fast on the bill. And if there's some way that we can bring, the opposition and the proponents together, some kind of workable arrangement, I'd like to see.
Now, I don't know exactly how the procedure is established for this.
Let me explain it to you, Ms. Kraft, and I agree with Alan 100% that this is a, many people have become so frustrated with the system, but they're not any more frustrated than we are, because it's a very time-consuming thing, but if you get to the corner, you should talk to this man and Ms. Walden and sit down and discuss the proposed amendments. I picked out three things that you might discuss in your testimony. And one would be that you make some sort of statement in the bill requiring these nonprofit corporations to make what you would consider to be proper distribution on dissolution. And the Oregon statutes provide that the articles of a nonprofit may provide for distribution to other nonprofit organizations or charities upon dissolution rather than to the lawyer and the farmer that you were talking about. So it should be that is plugged in. I think probably that's a good criticism. And in addition, you might consider the possibility of restricting this so that the nonprofit corporation can rent to migrants only. And I don't know how you're going to define migrants, but right now it appears to me that the lawyers could also rent out there. May read the bill some other way, but it's not limited to renting. Then in addition, I don't see anything in here, and probably you can't put it in, but I gather from your testimony there's no protection about the rental factor for the migrant. And that's my whole point. See, if it's picked up and the rental factor then becomes too great for the migrant, then does the nonprofit corporation have the right to rent persons other than migrants and still maintain the nonprofit status? You understand what I mean? But the process is that you get together with some people like Mr. Mann and Mr. Wallace who are pushing for this bill and you try to work out these compromises. They know where to go to get the amendments prepared. They have legal services available to them through legislative council and draft them, and they can do these things for you.
Sorry, I'd just like to make one moment, and there will be a bill that will be introduced, my understanding, that will upgrade Oregon's farm labor camp housing standards. And we would appreciate their support on this bill so that we can, meet that problem.
How long have you been testifying and sort of lobbying around the legislature?
I started in
69. 69. Well, you pretty much probably know the process by now, then. Do you have anything to add to that, Alan?
Well, the section on the I was struck particularly with Section 6 there on the appeal to the Department of Revenue, and I'm concerned about how does the court become involved, or does the court become involved? I'm wondering also why the Department of Revenue. There's something else in here. Because somebody is under the listed feedback to adjust your remedies to the Department of Revenue hearing first before you can get to the tax court, I would imagine.
Would you also agree that these camps should allow inspections to enter for inspection purposes and that rights tenants should have visiting privileges?
I don't know. You see, I don't know that Alan and I can say. What we can say is that we will take a look at your amendment. You can get the sponsors to agree to that, to put it in.
or even if they, we're probably going to have another hearing.
I don't know. Probably have a work session. We don't have a hearing.
And that's public.
Sure.
Even if they don't agree to any one or all of the amendments, I would encourage you to attend the next work session. To propose these amendments, at least they would be considered even as sponsored.
When will be next work session?
We don't know. The chairman called him generally, which would be Mr. Martin. Then he's Martin. I did talk to him and he might be able to. In fact, now you'll have an opportunity to meet him on a German scrap that represents man before he gets away.
Representative Ginsburg, would you, if I cannot meet Representative Martin, I was going to try to get him on, would you give me a call, Mr. Martin, next work session?
Well, the best thing for you to do probably, I don't think, is to call the committee clerk and ask her to get notified before.
Are there any more questions?
Not that I can think of.
I'm not to my committee.
Thank you. Anyone else testify on this bill? House Bill of 62. I didn't sign up. Well, then let's have you do that while we have your name. Leave that to Ms. or Mrs. Katz that wants to speak with you about possible compromise or.
Compromise.
Amendment to the bill.
Amendment.
Leave it as a heart.
Heart?
A heart.
My name is Michael Friel. I work at the Valley Migrant Lake in Woodburn. Mrs. Katz has discussed some of the things I was interested in the bill, and I intend to try to find myself something that I thought hadn't been raised. We do favor this bill to the extent that it does encourage better housing for farm workers, and we nevertheless had some questions as to whether the bill did that adequately. So we did have some recommendations toward that end. First of all, it probably should be noted that I don't think the bill would even require the non-profit corporation to own the land. It would, the farmer, as I understand it, could enter a simple agreement with some non-profit corporation, and then the farmer could retain the ownership, provided that the non-profit corporation merely operates it. And I think it would make provide very easily for every farmer in the state to take advantage of the provision. Secondly, I do think there should be some effort at making a package reform here in terms of upgrading the health code. I think the relief for the farmer and relief for the farm worker, at least in terms of adequate housing, really should go hand in hand. And I won't go over the ground that Mrs. Katz did, but I'll simply note that Oregon standards are lower, and perhaps the compliance should be required either with the federal standards or the bill should be delayed until the new standards that, as I understand it, will be recommended, and so these new standards can be considered at the same time. You could, for instance, have a situation where a camp violated federal regulations and was unable to recruit workers through the employment service. So it could be in violation of federal regulations and yet still comply with Oregon health standards and receive tax-exempt status. And I just wonder whether that kind of situation would be an appropriate one for tax-exempt status. Now, to go on to a couple of other points, not only the local health officer inspects the camps, also the Bureau of Labor and Employment Security is at least authorized to do so, although as I understand it, it contracts with the Board of Health for them to take the function. But nevertheless, it would seem appropriate for the local health officer at least to consult with the Bureau of Labor before certifying compliance. and indeed to consult with the State Board of Health before certifying compliance. And the local health officer should not certify compliance where he was directed not to do so by the State Board of Health. This would preserve the same structure that exists in the present law, where the State Board of Health can step in if the job is not being done properly at the local level. And perhaps the existing structure should be preserved here as well, where the State Board of Health would at least have the power to overrule the local health officer as it does in matters of inspection generally. Secondly, the question of inspection was touched on a little bit. I do not believe the local health officer should certify compliance unless he has indeed inspected the camp. And I'm not sure that is required under this bill. And the local health officer, furthermore, should not certify compliance for any farm labor camp where access for inspection was denied to either the local health officer or to the State Board of Health, the Bureau of Labor, or the Employment Division. Some inspectors have reported a denial of access. In some cases, it may have been representatives of the health department were allowed in, representatives of the labor department were not. This kind of situation at least could arise. And regardless of other sanctions for denial of access for inspection, reasonable inspections, regardless of the other sanctions that might be permitted, certainly it would seem to me that operators should not receive tax exemptions where they're unwilling to permit reasonable inspections. Finally, I guess there are two more points. I find the question of compliance to be fairly vague. I'm not sure at what point compliance is required. Can the operator be in compliance in June and not in July and then back in compliance in August? And I think there should be some clearer wording of what type of compliance has to be sought, or at least compliance at what point. And perhaps the way to express that clearly would be simply to say that the local health officer shall not certify compliance for any labor camp which has failed to comply with the standards at any time during the calendar year. Otherwise, I just don't think it's at all clear as to what constitutes compliance. Finally, I noticed in line 12, the compliance required is with the health code for farm labor camps promulgated under ORS 446-600. At the present time, House Bill 1048 has been introduced to create a state building code commission. And part of this bill affects farm labor camps. I believe section 26 indicates that regulations now under the State Board of Health, issued by the State Board of Health, might be taken over. I haven't had a chance to really study this bill, but might be taken over by the new Building Code Commission. In that event, this would apply to construction of water supply facilities and toilet facilities. The regulations for these toilet facilities and water supply facilities at farm labor camps would be the responsibility of the State Building Code Commission. Would this bill then mean that farm labor camps would not have to comply with those regulations? And if that is the case, then I think there should be some amendment of this section to indicate that compliance would have to be not merely with regulations under 446-600, but also regulations regarding, if this bill passes, regarding water supply and toilet facilities. So there's been some requirement of compliance with such additional laws and regulations applicable to farm labor camps as may be enacted hereafter. I think the suggestion to meet with the proponents of this bill is a very good one, and I think it would be very difficult.
Is that it?
Well, I put my time in the
before the committee.